As many listeners know, between Uncharted, Top Shelf, and all the other things I do, I'm on an airplane a good amount. What you probably don't know is that my secret weapon for flying abroad is FlyFlat. That's right, FlyFlat is a luxury concierge platform that has the absolute best prices on long-haul, international, business, and first-class tickets. And here's the kicker, they have a 24/7 concierge team that gives everyone they work with truly white-glove service. They are run by a good friend of mine, an Uncharted member, and they specialize in working with business owners and investors like myself, as well as comprehensively taking care of all business travel for funds, family offices, and boutique consulting firms. Quick story, this past summer I was in Portugal and I needed to get back to NYC the very next day. I hit up the FlyFlat team on WhatsApp and 20 minutes later they had me a LieFlat seat back to New York, one way direct for 90% off the retail price. I was an instant convert and I've used FlyFlat ever since. Now I just book a day or two advance when I'm 100% sure I need to head out. FlyFlat takes care of the rest. It's not for everybody, but for me, I love it. And if you're listening to this podcast, I have a feeling you might love it too. If you're interested in learning more or trying it out for yourself, go to flyflat.com/uncharted. That's fly-flat.com/uncharted and receive $250 off your first flight. Zach and the FlyFlat team do an outstanding job. I'm proud to call them Uncharted partners and friends. And if you're listening to this episode, I highly encourage you give the FlyFlat team a shot.
Welcome to the Uncharted Podcast. Uncharted is a community of some of the world's best entrepreneurs, founders, investors, creatives, and beyond. At our dinners and at our annual summit in New York, we have dialogues with people who are truly at the top of their game across every industry. This podcast is designed really to offer the world and the audience a peek into the magical conversations that happen behind closed doors at our events, and more importantly, a peek into the brains of people who are truly at the top of their game. My goal with every guest is that if you know them well, you'll hear them talk about something or say something they've really never said before, and if you've never heard of them, you'll know exactly what makes them such a badass by the time the episode is over. Welcome to Uncharted. We're glad you're here.
Welcome back to the Uncharted Podcast. We have the amazing Haley Schwartz here. Haley founded Actual Veggies, which makes supposedly, I haven't tried it yet, which is embarrassing, but supposedly the world's best veggie burgers. You've carved out, I would say, a leading position in what may sound like a niche, but it's actually not, because vegetarian is a huge market, which you'll tell us about. Over 12 million in revenue, 6,000 retail doors, remarkable growth in a very challenging category and also a very challenging CPG market. Haley's been to a number of Uncharted events and is an active participant in the community, and it's just always fun to jam CPG with you. So Haley, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the state of the vegetarian market. Why did you pick this lane? Why vegetarian? Give us some market sizing, give us the framing of the opportunity, and tell us like what the first few years looked like.
Yeah, so big secret, I actually eat meat. So I am also surprised that I ended up in this lane. But my co-founder, Jason, stopped eating meat at the end of 2019 for health reasons. And he really saw that while Beyond Impossible were touting their burger, he quickly realized that wasn't healthy for you. You could get a good veggie burger at a restaurant, but if you went to the grocery store, there really wasn't any true innovation in the actual true veggie burger space. So we wanted to do what Beyond Impossible did for fake meat to real veggie burgers. And the idea was to bring a delightful, delicious experience around something that like had sort of been ignored. What we didn't realize was that it is a quite a big market and it's actually not new to eat veggie burgers. But what's been awesome is Beyond Impossible has spent a ton of money on telling people that they should eat less meat. And now all of a sudden, these people who want to eat less meat are looking for a new veggie-forward product because the media has now exposed the not so great things about Beyond Impossible. You know, just going on for me personally, like I said, I do eat meat, but I like to eat clean whole foods. My co-founder, Jason, said I had to try Beyond Impossible. When we started the company, I refused to. My stomach just like literally, like I can't, I have a visceral reaction. And you hear that over and over again to something that's not real. At the same time, I always love a good veggie burger and I'm happy to have one.
So when did you start the company?
Weirdly, we started it in March, like 6, 2020. Like, so it was sort of crazy because we didn't know COVID was happening, but at the same time, we don't know any different. Everyone said, oh, it must have been so hard to start a company during COVID. But for us, like, it actually was quite easy because we didn't know anything different. all of our first time raising money, our first time talking to our buyers and category managers was actually over Zoom. We were in person. We never had a go-to-market plan that involved real life. And if anything, the transition for us was as the world opened up, we're like, oh, you have to go meet in person and go to Ohio and Texas and, you know, all these places to talk to big grocery buyers. We just want to get on Zoom so we can do more meetings.
Right. One of the things that always sticks out to me about CPG companies or companies in general is that people in the entrepreneurial space hear stories of people starting these consumer packaged food companies. And they're like, you know, Haley saw white space that no one had made a good veggie burger. She started a company and now she's doing $12 million. Like, that's a playbook. I can go do that myself, which in some way is true, but in other ways misses all the nuance of how remarkably hard it is to start a CPG company. Everything from making the product not taste like cardboard to getting the margins right, to getting it onto the shelves, to capitalizing the business. Give us some of the early stories of, you say, okay, you and Jace are going to start this business. We're going to go after veggie burgers. How do you get to V1 ready to get on shelves?
To be honest, there was a lot of luck, as like people say. It was a pretty easy time to raise money in 2020, 2021. So that definitely helped us. The other interesting thing about me is I'm very conservative. Jason's a risk taker. So I was really scared about spending money and even overly raising. So while we could get a valuation that was like 40 to 80x revenue, like, we didn't. So I think that actually ended up saving us, which is sort of crazy, because I was like, the way I have always spent money has been very careful, and I'm very structured and scared, and I don't want to overspend. So that was like something that was great for us, that it was easy to raise money and then that we didn't overraise at an insanely high valuation. So that like set us out with the foundation to get this going. Another great thing was Jason has no fear and he has no anxiety. It's like the weirdest thing. I'm a very anxious person. So it was always like, we said yes, and we always would figure it out. So if we were going to get in front of a buyer or a category manager, it was like, we have this burger ready to go for you. And then, did we have our co-packer yet? No, probably not. But like, we could figure this out. We can empty a tray. Early days, like, we would go to the grocery store, we would buy a tray of another product that had a similar dimension of us. We'd clean it out. We put our burger in it. We'd add a packaging, like, we'd print up a package design on top of it and then send it to our buyer.
We need to double click on that story because that's hilarious. And I just want to be abundantly clear about what's happening for the audience. The Kroger buyer, as an example, says, okay, Haley and Jason, we'll take a meeting. What do you got? Tell us what actual veggies. Send us some samples. And so you go into Kroger and just pick something that's already there, like a veggie burger B, take it out of the veggie burger B packaging, put it into your own fabricated packaging and send it to your
store. We would make our own recipe. Don't get me wrong. No. Yeah, no, we would take a tray or we'd order empty trays, whatever it would be. But we were saying that they were made in our factory. But to be honest, a lot of our samples at the beginning were handmade. And that was just sort of like, here we are, we handmade it. We would say it was ready to go. And it was going to be ready to go. We were positive about that. But it was just like, in order to open a factory, you need to have a big order. So it's like this chicken or egg thing. And we couldn't just do that for samples.
Who was the first retailer that said yes?
Weirdly, we launched with QVC, which I actually think was...
QVC?
Yeah.
Like the infomercial TV thing.
Yeah. So fun fact, I am a QVC star. I don't know if you want my autograph, but I've hosted QVC multiple times, which is a fun experience to do. And what was really great about that is you don't make any money, but a few things that I think are cool about QVC is, if someone said, would you want to get in front of 100,000 people who are probably 40 to 65 years old moms living in middle America states for free and talk about your product for 10 minutes, do you want to do it?
I would like to do that, yes.
Yeah. So it's like, even if you don't actually make any money. So that was like one insight for us, that we're like talking to these customers. I'm telling them about our product. I'm telling them how to make it, how they can use it for 10 minutes. And then while our margins were basically nothing, maybe negative, like, it was still worth a lot. And because also
QVC specifically, or just because you were so early?
So early. Because then, because of that, we were able to open up a co-packer, because it was enough, the minimums to open up a co-packer or fulfill it by QVC.
So you fix your cold start problem by going on QVC, getting orders and using those orders to do your first production run?
Yep. And then fix our like actual product based on the feedback from the customers.
Were the first products that came off the line the ones that went to the QVC customers?
I mean, we did a trial run, but yeah, the first pretty much.
How many did you sell on QVC?
I think it was 1,200 units.
Which is 1,200 more than you told before. Then what happens?
I think it was... This is actually crazy. There's a few times I've cried at the company, not from being angry or sad, but from happiness, which one of them was Wegmans, our buyer, went on General Actual Veggies and was like, I found your product in this, like, it was like a small, it's something called Pop-Up Grocer in New York, which is like a museum of cool new foods. She's like, I would like to bring it in. So she found our product on our General at actualveggies.com.
Oh my God. That's probably one of the best days. I mean, that's a life-changing day.
Yeah, that was a life-changing day. And then another cool thing that we did was we worked with all these online retailers. D2C was really big in 2020 and 2021, as you know. But for us, it was too hard to do with like frozen product. It's really expensive. Like, it's just a pain in the ass. But a lot of these online retailers were really growing because people weren't going to the grocery store. So we would work with someone like Hungaroo, and they would take our product and they would ship it directly to their customers in a box of recipes and ingredients. They're still one of our biggest partners. And not only are the margins really great with online retailers because you're not working with a distributor, but also, again, I'm using their community to market. So I'm not building my own community. And instead, I'm talking to their customers about our product who are discovering us through Hungaroo. Now, when I like think of our marketing strategy, I still think about Hungaroo. Butcher Box, where Butcher Box is only veggie burger, which is a very different audience than Hungaroo. And then we're Purple Carrot. We work with Purple Carrot, which is a vegan delivery service. Obviously for them, like we're a huge product, but it's like all these different communities are very different from each other. And really we get to speak to them all in different ways.
I want to nerd out a little bit on CPG. And for the audience listening, the reason I nerd out on CPG is obviously I'm very deep in the alcohol business. So I think about these types of things often. When you think about, let's just start with retail, because I think for the average entrepreneurial consumer, this will resonate with them and people who are listening. The game in retail, Haley, is obviously a mix between the following, which is how many doors are you in? How quickly do you move through those doors? And what's your margin? It's those three things. Those are the dials you can turn. So give us a sense from how Actual Veggie thinks about the world. How do you think about retail? What is your strategy there to focus on points of distribution versus velocity? What do you do to affect those things? And how has that evolved since you started the company?
Our black bean veggie burger is just in almost every grocery store, both conventional and natural, is the best selling veggie burger already, which is really exciting. But our goal and what we're laser focused on is getting that second and third SKU that is going to do just as well as that black bean burger. To me, getting into a new retailer is like exciting, but like succeeding at a retailer is like very important to me.
Yeah.
Thinking about how to support that. For our product, it's going to lean towards a grocery store like Whole Foods, which is much more natural leaning. And so all of our innovation, we're going to launch with Whole Foods, because if it's not going to succeed at Whole Foods, it's not going to succeed anywhere else. And Whole Foods is going to support us in thinking through that. And the thought leadership there, the ingredient standards, the understanding of their customer, that's like the shoppers who we want to meet. So like, as much as I love Kroger and Albertsons, and I've told them this directly, I'm going to say no if they ask for a new product. I'm like, I'm too scared of you guys. Like, it's only one part of it, which is something we had to learn, that it's only one part of it to get into that grocery store. It's to stay on shelf and make sure that you have the right selection for that grocery store, which sort of does change between conventional, a Kroger and a Whole Foods. Like, it's really interesting how different that customer is.
Teach the audience more about what that means, right? So the difference between getting on the shelf and staying on the shelf. How does a entrepreneur of a CPG company think about that dynamic? And what can you actually do tactically yourselves or within your business to try to affect, obviously getting in, you need to have a good pitch, but how do you affect staying on those shelves? What does that dynamic look like?
I've never been afraid to say no, because at the end of the day, the buyer at Whole Foods is like one part. But like I said before, if we are not selling well within a year, you can be off that shelf. So instead, I'm thinking, really, is this going to stay on shelf? And is the consumer going to want it? Some of the things I've learned recently in our space is like, as fun as like cool new flavors are, people are like pretty boring in what they want. They want to be the ones to dress it up. So it's like, we had like an idea of like a pizza veggie burger, and it's like, sounds so fun. I didn't even know if I thought it sounded so fun, but at the end of the day, that like plain black bean flavor, that's what's exciting to customers. They want to put the like chimichurri sauce on it. They want to add the spice. They want to do all these things. And like, so being boring in our innovation is like sort of new in how we're thinking about it. And then when we're on shelf, what's been coming really exciting to me is how to support that. Like, I'm not doing events. Like, as sexy and fun as it would be to do an event like with one of your alcohol companies, at most events, people are drinking and they're going to eat free food and never remember that product unless I'm much bigger. For like brand awareness, and you know this, like you have to see the product multiple times in multiple places to even sort of get the inkling of to remember to buy it at the grocery store. Instead, I'm going to put the product on sale. The cheapest way to get people to try it is just, you know, offer 50 cents off, support it that way. Another thing that's really been exciting and interesting to me is Instacart. So especially in our category, people are over-indexing on shopping through Instacart through the grocery store. So that counts towards our movement. And it's the first time that you get to think of a different way to get someone to your aisle. Like, I came from a tech background and paid media is much more understandable to me than trying to get someone to walk to the freezer. So if I can get someone who's searching for spinach and now all of a sudden I'm targeting them with a Super Greens burger, that's like really interesting and a totally new customer that probably wouldn't have gone to the freezer.
Right. Is there a strategy for doing samplings and tastings?
Yes. So doing demos at grocery stores is something that we're starting to invest more and more in. Again, I am excited about it, but I'm also cognizant of the fact that more and more people are shopping through Instacart. And I'm like, as much as I want to give snacks to the people who are walking, you know, who are the Instacart buyers, especially in New York City, like, is it better money to spend that money on Instacart and see if people will click on that?
Again, my world is alcohol, so Instacart is not as much of a factor. Like, it's a different ballgame. You think there's enough of an implication of Instacart shoppers being in store that it actually would make samplings maybe not worth it?
Yes, stores in New York City. Maybe not in Tribeca. And I'm not positive about this. We're still doing demoing. Certain stores, I would say, yeah, maybe not. For demoing, especially for a product like ours, we have to bring in an oven. It's different. Quite expensive. It's different. A lot of like people on the ground. And I'm like, why not just do this through Instacart?
Wow. So what's the plan for 2025? You're in 6,000 doors now. What happens this year?
Hire and putting a more robust research project together that, you know, I was asking you guys about the community about hiring. I'm still doing a lot of our sales, which I will always do, but we've been so tight and so lean. And I think just adding some more people to the team will let us be a little more diligent, really understanding how to optimize and then starting to do a little more exciting marketing. Like I said, we've been lean in every aspect of it. Obviously going into new grocery stores, but at this point, my excitement is around when we're expanded in a certain grocery store, when they add a new SKU and not necessarily a brand new grocery store.
Got it. And what about on the digital side?
On the digital side, it's Instacart's my best friend. I went to the Instacart. My background, I was in product, Alibaba most recently, but I've always been tech product. So when I went to Instacart and I was like talking to people who are doing food and tech all day, I was like, do I quit actual veggies and go back to this? I was like, I have 400 ideas for you. Like, let's do this. Let's do this. Let's do that.
Give it to them through actual veggies and make sure they prioritize you in the
team. Well, yeah, I'm doing like 15 pilots for the Instacart right now. So they're literally my best friends.
That's a good relationship you got there. That's amazing. Cool. All right. So digital is Instacart. And I'm assuming you have a paid media strategy. I'm assuming you're on Amazon.
Well, we're on WholeFoods.com. We're not on Amazon right now because with Amazon, we still have to ship and it's hard for us. We have a great influencer network through our investors. We have really great investors so we definitely always are sending product out that way. And then dietitians, moms, like we're starting to inundate in communities where we think veggie burgers will be like really exciting and well received. And then the other part of it is we're really growing our food service business. So working with college and universities and in restaurants to serve us, to brand us on the menu, which is, I thought retail was hard. Food service is, it's hard.
Let's talk about something that comes up at every Uncharted dinner in the Uncharted WhatsApp constantly and is a constant top of mind thing for all entrepreneurs, which is fundraising. You mentioned at the top of this pod that you lucked out. I don't know if I would call it luck, but you started raising in 2020, which was a good time to be raising. The fundraising landscape evolved dramatically. Just give us a very quick high level and then we can get into a bit. How much did you raise in your first round? What was that like? And what's the fundraising experience been like since then?
Yeah. So when we first raised, having an idea, we were able to raise on an idea. We weren't in any grocery stores. We got into an accelerator that focused on plant-based foods. And they gave us $125,000 in cash and then some services. And then from there, it was like the idea of going on QVC, going into Wegmans, going in the hangar, that was enough to raise our next round, which was about $2 million. We've raised $7 million to date. It has changed so much. I think it was like, it was on convertible notes, but it was like 20x revenue. We were being offered like 30 to 40x revenue in 2021, but I think we did 20x, which was low. Like, it was sort of crazy because you remember the time when like food companies were being valued like tech companies. It was crazy. And now we sort of evened out, cleaned up our cap table. We've raised $7 million to date, and it's all about being profitable. It's 2 to 3x net revenue. And it's not about what grocery stores you're getting into. It's about how well you're doing in those grocery stores.
Velocity, right?
Velocity. Like, I feel lucky because we're hitting those metrics, but it's sort of been like, it's been a whirlwind because rectifying, you know, this like really cheap, easy money we got, and now sort of having to show all those things, which is growth, profitability, like low multiples, and still make it worthwhile for us. Finding that mix has been humbling. But like I said, I do feel like really lucky because we were pretty diligent, pretty lean when we were asked not to be. Because of that, we're in a pretty good place.
I'm just thinking about the dynamic of the landscape for the last 3 years. All these food companies that have raised so much money. I mean, there was the whole controversy of Better Bagel. I'm sure you're following it, right? That was a... For the audience who wasn't listening, a crazy situation where like this company raised tens of millions of dollars to create a better bagel, like a low carb thing. And they were doing well on Whole Foods and they were doing well and they had a big business. And then all of a sudden the thing, through some comedy of errors, it seemed like there was all sorts of public stuff that came out that they weren't paying their bills and customers were getting orders and the website went down and it was like, the thing is dead. And then the founder came back online and said, no, I'm sorry, I was just on vacation or something, but I'm back. And everyone was like, okay, it's fine. And then it wasn't fine. And everything's now back to chaos. And like, no one knows what's going on, but something clearly ain't right. That is probably the most public of the falls from grace. Maybe, I don't know, Better Bagels, so I hope they're okay. But like, there's a lot of that that's happened. And so your point is that you just stayed disciplined when you need to, because you could have raised probably $100 million if you wanted to.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
All because you're just such a disciplined operator.
Well, that's the complimentary way to say it. This is actually the ironic part is, I think my co-founder thought we could raise at a much higher valuation. So we were raising in July 2021, and he thought we would be able to raise at a much higher valuation in September 2021. So I was like, then why are we taking this much money? We shouldn't take this much money if we're going to raise at a higher valuation in a few months. So I like stopped us from raising more than we should have because I thought we were going to raise again and it was going to be easy again. But yeah, even when we had the money, we were always so careful about how we've spent it. And grocery is so expensive. If someone said to me, like, I want to get into this, I'd 99% of the time say, no, don't do this. So it's such a grind. It's not easy at all. And what we think of as a good idea doesn't always translate to what people will actually buy on shelf. Like,
yeah,
who they want and what they'll actually buy is very different.
Let's unpack this one just a little bit because it's kind of where we started the episode. And so I'd like to kind of circle back to it. I feel like most common ideas that aspiring entrepreneurs have is that they go to the grocery store. I see this all the time in booze as well. They're like, hey, Clooney sold Casavigos for $1 billion. We should start a tequila. I wish there was a better type of bagel. All these things that sound very exciting because they're tangible. And then the departure between the idea being good and you actually having a place in your life where you've made money from the thing is such a big chasm. Like, just talk more about why that is.
It's a really expensive, capital heavy business. And I think at the end of the day, like a lot of people who start food companies are very idealistic of like what people want. You'll hear like people say, oh, I wish that I could have something with no oil, no sugar, and taste amazing. Well, then to make it do all those things, it might end up on shelf at $12.99 and your competitor's $4.99. So it's like, in order to get really to get people to buy things multiple times, it has to be at a price that they
right.
comfortable with. And maybe in New York City, that's a little different. But like the rest of the US, especially right now, that's not the case. Like a dollar really matters. You know, there's not only like finding the factory of where to do it, but distribution's extremely expensive, as I'm sure you know that. There's always, whenever there's issues like late fees or any issue you could expect and more, the chargebacks are insane in the business. I think something that keeps us up a little bit at night is food safety. You can have something go wrong that's out of your control, and all of a sudden you know, I talked to an ice cream brand that there was like a listeria breakout, and started, he's like, I can't get through it. I just can't. Like, he had to buy back all his inventory, and he could have raised more money. And he's like, it was in one day, I'm like getting chills. I think about this, but my whole company, it was like, it wasn't worth it to me anymore. I couldn't fight another day. So there are just things that come out every single day. And food is weirdly an art too. Like, it's not, we've had issues where we've done a run and we realize, oh, like someone used like too much pepper. It's a recipe. Like, for us, it's like not science. It's a lot of art in there. So, you know, there's human error. There's all these other things that can happen. And just being aware of it. So it's definitely, it's not fun. Luckily, like, I have my brother who's part of the team, and he gets to deal with all that stuff. You know, there's just been issue after issue, like, of things happening, and it's a lot.
I ask this question to a lot of entrepreneurs who you get a couple cocktails in them and they tell you the truth. So I'm curious if you'll be honest about it. Knowing everything you know about how hard this has been, would you do it again?
Yes, because I'm having the time of my life. Like, I feel really lucky because we've created a somewhat successful business. I mean, I don't know if it's going to change my life in the end, but like, I get to pay myself a reasonable salary. I get to talk to cool people all day. I love our team. I love our product. Yeah, I would, but I don't know if I would create another food company. So I just, because I, like I said, I do think there was some luck in us stumbling in a category that actually needed innovation and that was open for that innovation.
Right.
I think what most people realize as they get further into their category, that category didn't need innovation. So it's like, you have to find that true white space.
Got it. What's top of mind for you right now?
You know, I think I mentioned this. We are closing a Series A that's taken a lot of energy. I'm excited to get that done. I'm excited to build out the team and sort of start spending money as like a leader in the category, instead of just being very lean and just building processes. Like, it's not sexy, but like, I'm so excited to have some more order in this business and really start to build off of data versus, like, I guess, like someone, my investor says, like, insights versus instinct. You know, that's like really exciting to me, because I just, the optimization piece of it is like something I feel much more comfortable in versus like a brand new idea.
All right. So if you're in Denver, hit up Haley. If you want the best veggie burgers in the market, hit up Actual Veggies. And great to see you. Thanks for being a part of Uncharted, as always.
Thank you.